Welcome to the Sports Medicine Podcast, brought to you by the Sidney and J.L. Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance in the Department of Health and Kinesiology at Texas A&M University. At the Huffines Institute, we're always working to facilitate, apply, and bring you the most up-to-date coverage of the wide world that is sports medicine and human performance, all in a language you can understand and share with your friends. And now, here's our host, the director of the Huffines Institute, Dr. Tim Lightfoot.
Well, hello and welcome to the weekly edition of the podcast from the Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance. I'm your host, Tim Lightfoot, and I'd like to thank you all for downloading us and taking the time to listen. Every week we bring you interesting individuals from the world of sports medicine who have a story to tell. And today, as I always say, is no exception. We have with us, I think, our first four-time repeat guest, Mr. David Ebstein, who is a senior writer with Sports Illustrated. Welcome back to the podcast, David.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be back.
Yeah, and you can listen to our previous podcast to get more autobiographical information on David and find out, get some links to his stories and stuff. But I do want to say and congratulate David on being, he was nominated for the Livingston Award this year, which is an award that's given in the United States to the best young journalist under the age of 35, and it was a great accomplishment to be nominated.
Thanks very much. Yeah, I was honored. I appreciate it.
Yeah. We're going to put, and what we're going to do is put links to the articles that got him nominated, and they are incredible piece of journalism there, so congratulations. But we've asked Dave to come back onto the podcast with us today. We've got the Olympics coming up. That's going to be part of his coverage for Sports Illustrated. And we want to chat a little bit about how stories come about in those kind of magazines. So let's start off with the Olympics, Dave. Let's just start off with a big question. What are the big stories that you see coming out of the Olympics? Which are the ones that you are most interested in seeing?
Well, so outside of just the straight sports story, so obviously I'm pretty interested as a track guy to see if Johan Blake beats his training partner, Usain Bolt. I think there'll be a lot of eyes on that. But from this kind of sports science and medicine perspective, I think two of the most interesting stories are out of South Africa. One being quarter-miler Oscar Pistorius, who was born without fibula and had his lower legs amputated before he was 1 year old. You know, he's well known as the Blade Runner because he runs on these carbon fiber sort of springs, basically, these crescent springs. There's been a lot of controversy about whether or not he's had an unfair advantage. And he actually hasn't, he also runs the race in a sort of non-traditional way. He'll speed up a lot in the second half of the race. And he was initially barred from competition and then reinstated based on, you know, what one scientist found, and then it found that he was at an advantage, and then another group of scientists sort of reversed that, but there's still lingering controversy. And he'll be at least presumably in the relay team for South Africa and will be the first, the first Paralympian to compete ever in an able-bodied Olympics. So that'll be really interesting.
Now, he did make the South African team?
He hasn't made it as an individual. He has one more shot to qualify as an individual.
Okay.
But he is in their relay pool at the moment, so he should at least be in their 4x400-meter relay. He still may make it as an individual because he qualified for world championships last year and was the first amputee ever to compete in the able-bodied world championships.
Right.
If he doesn't make the standard in his next race, then he'll be strictly on the relays.
And I would encourage our listeners, if you want to know more about the Pistorius story, you can listen back to some of our podcasts, earlier podcasts with David and with Ross Tucker, where we have covered that quite extensively. But it is an interesting whole story about competitive advantage and the use of technology. So that will be interesting to watch and see what happens.
Yeah, and then another big kind of sports science medicine threat of South Africa, of course, is Caster Semenya, who was the 800-meter runner who came out of nowhere and then kind of made headlines across the world at the center of what reporters have called a gender controversy, basically, of some of Caster Semenya's competitors because of her sort of physique, her quick drop in time and sort of deep voice and things like that, said, hey, look, we want to make sure that this is a woman we're competing against. And, so this is going to be Caster's sort of first time back on the global stage. And she won the world championship by just flattening everyone else in the world. So that'll be really interesting to see how she performs.
Yeah,
some people suggest that she's been sort of sandbagging races in order not to draw attention before the Olympics.
Hmm. Yeah, and that controversy really hadn't gone away, has it, since it first came up a few years back?
No, not at all, because we're not, you know, the prophets were supposed to remain private, you know, whether or not Castor underwent any medical procedures. But obviously it wasn't private, but nobody knows for sure whether Castor has been ordered to undergo sort of any medical procedures, and she hasn't been running at the level that she was before this controversy. But nobody knows why that is, you know, if that's from any kind of hormone treatment or just, you know, natural lunar fluctuation.
Yeah. Yeah, and that leads into a whole another topic that we will probably cover on another podcast, which you've written about recently, which is transgendered athletes that are trying to participate, and, you know, how and where do these folks fit in the pantheon of sport?
One other thing that actually pops to mind that I'll be interested to see from the sports science perspective is, you know, last Olympics we had all the swimming records were obliterated. Mm. Now those special body suits have been banned, and I'm curious to see if suddenly we don't have, because usually records are broken like crazy in swimming at Olympics, you know, much more so than on the track. I'm curious to see if that changes now because of those suits, or if the progression still continues.
Right. Interesting. Yeah, and again, once again, technology coming to play a role here. So any other areas? So we've talked about swimming. We've talked about track. Any other areas that you think there may be interesting stories that come out that you can tell us about? I'm sure you've got a list of people you're going to interview when you're there, so we don't want to scoop your stories.
Oh, no, for sure. I mean, you know, a lot of the stuff I'll be paying attention to is, of course, from sort of the straight sports perspective, right? Like, I want to see, you know, what happens on the track and things like that. And, I don't know if it was the last time or two times ago when I did the podcast, I was actually in Qatar, Doha, at the Arab Games.
Yeah.
And I'm going to be pretty interested to see if some of those athletes I met there even show up, you know, because as happy as they were sort of about having revolutions in their countries that helped overthrow sort of dictatorships in some cases or oppressive regimes, they were saying it was as bad as ever for athletes because whatever structure they had in place, you know, for a sports federation basically disappeared with the government in a lot of cases. So I'm curious to see if those athletes show up, and especially if, you know, I don't know if you read about this, but yesterday or 2 days ago, Saudi Arabia finally agreed to send a female athlete for the first time ever.
Right. That was the next question I was going to ask you, so that's great timing there.
Okay, yeah. So there's only three countries that have never had a woman at the Olympics: Qatar, Brunei, and Saudi Arabia.
Mm.
And Saudi Arabia will be the only one left at this Olympics if they don't send a woman, so they've sort of over the last couple of months gone back and forth about whether they would or they wouldn't, and then most recently they said they would, and people were reporting that it would be this equestrian athlete named Dalma Malhas, but she hasn't qualified.
Oh.
So she's not going to go, so now it's totally unclear if there is, in fact, going to be a female Saudi athlete or not.
And it's, I think many of our listeners, that sounds so foreign that there is a big debate as to whether or not you would send a female athlete to the Olympics.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's, you know, I think we're this year celebrating the 40th anniversary of Title IX, and for me, it's hard to imagine. It's hard to imagine what people write about how it was before that, you know, how scant women's sports participation was. So, you know, when I was in Qatar, and you see the Saudi delegation, which is like 300 and some odd athletes strong and no women, it's definitely strange.
Yeah. So speaking of these kinds of events, let's morph and talk a little bit about how these stories develop. Let's speak about the Olympics. So you're being sent to the Olympics by Sports Illustrated. Do you go with a list of story ideas in advance, or do you just go and kind of hang out and let the stories find you, or is it a mixture of both? How do you start to generate those ideas for stories?
It's more of the former. It's more of the having ideas going in, and then you'll have a bunch of them, and then, you know, it's like shooting clay pigeons. Like, some of them don't work out or whatever, so you start crossing them out and seeing which ones you can get done. But, like, for example, and then, you know, being aware of whatever goes on. So my first Olympics as a reporter was Beijing, and there, you know, there's some built-in things, right? Like, you know that people are going to try to protest, and you know that China's not used to having public protests.
Right.
So you know you're going to pay some visits to the protest sites. And you know, my a lot of my academic background was in environmental sciences, and so I knew there were a lot of pollution issues and things like that, and so I had basically prepped about 80% of a three-part series on the Chinese environment that I then just sort of filled in with details that I needed on the ground, so it was already very much ready. You know, not quite like a Mad Lib where I'm just, like, filling in quotes, but I had, like, really the structure of it.
Right.
And in both of the last two Olympics, so Beijing and Vancouver, and again, Vancouver, there was more kind of environmental stories with El Nino, with, like, ruining the skiing venue and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And so I knew that was coming, so I prepped for it. And in both of those Olympics, somebody, I've actually been on the first day of the Olympics reporting about someone who died. Because one of my beats, sort of being a non-traditional beat reporter in sports, is anything crazy that happens, basically.
Oh, yeah.
AM.
Yeah.
And so in China, was the father-in-law of the men's volleyball coach was killed at a tourist site in kind of a random crime. And in Vancouver, it was the luge athlete who flew off the course. Mm. And I had done a little bit of writing about how that course was actually accidentally engineered to be too fast, so that kind of played into my hand in that sense. But, I mean, as we've gotten closer and closer to the Olympics, you know, I'll go to events where athletes are showing up. Like, there was a pro track meet in New York a couple weeks ago, and I'll go there and start interviewing everybody, and already your interviews are lining up your storylines that you might want in the Olympics.
Right.
So it was much more that than covering the meet. So,
yeah.
Absolutely, I think it's much more of lining things up ahead of time and then with some bit of reacting to the news near there.
Yeah. And this last point that you just made about reacting to the news is there. It really segues into a thought that I'd had as I thought about this podcast, which was, it seems like there's a couple of different types of stories, one of which, of course, is the news of what's actually happening, who won the 100 meters, and whether or not it was a dead heat and how you break ties and stuff like that.
Right.
But there's also the background stories that actually add to the content and the flavor and the stories that we've all gotten accustomed to over the years, to tell the stories of some of the athletes behind the scenes and some of the issues that are going on behind the scenes, very much like you talked about the environmental issues and so forth. So it really seems like there's a couple of flavors of stories, one that happens while you're there and the other one that you actually start to prepare for.
Absolutely, and I think now, you know, and there's some combinations of those where more and more now it's like you can watch live streaming or you can watch on 50 different channels or whatever it is.
Right.
So if we're just going there and sort of doing the AP, like, you know, Usain Bolt blew out of the blocks and dusted the competition, he's won X medal, that doesn't really cut it anymore, I don't think, because people can get that on their own. So you know, you just popped into my head when you said it, but, like, so now in the last, you know, 18 months or so, I've been to Jamaica to report on running there. I've been to Kenya to learn about running there, and did a lot of reporting that didn't show up in any of my stories, a little bit of choke in the book, but I'm definitely going to bring some of those recordings, and when people start asking the same thing they're asking Beijing, like, what the heck's going on in Jamaica? They're going so good, you know, they're doing so well. I'm going to have some of this reporting that's kind of in my back pocket that, you know, then I'll trot out some of the backstory.
Yeah. So it really seems that journalism is, and this type of reporting in particular, is really morphing into a type of what we would also used to think about just as writers who would write longer pieces.
I think you sort of hit it on the head there, and I think that that sort of thesis is really supported by what you see happening in the industry right now with things like projects like Grantland, you know, ESPN's Grantland, and I know there are two other projects, independent projects, that are starting up for sports writing, and they're not people starting new newspapers. They're people starting operations aimed at long-form sports writing. So
yeah.
I think, yeah, very much, you know, move sort of away from, like the traditional kind of sports writing to, like, writing that happens to be about sports.
Right. Do your editors play any role in the development of ideas? I mean, do you guys, you know, you always hear about bullpens and writing bullpens. Do you guys sit around and go, oh, I think this is going to be a great idea, and the editor goes, yeah, go follow that one, or here's something that no one's thought about, go follow this one?
There's some of that, and not as much for us as there is a newspaper, but it does sort of ramp up at the Olympics, because that's the one, like, our writers are scattered all over the country, and so at the Olympics, we actually have something resembling an office more, so there's a little more brainstorming, because we're all in the same place at the same time.
Yeah.
And then it depends by writer, so for me, I tend to generate more of my story ideas, because I'm not, you know, Peter King, who, like, knows he's going to the NFL game of the week every week.
Right, right.
And so they rely on me a little bit more to do things like, you know, meet people at the Huffines talk and pick their brain and maybe come up with some ideas and sort of generate my own story ideas.
Right, right.
But there's like the you know, when I was in Qatar reporting on the Arab Games, that was totally an editor generated thing. And the editor said, look, there, you know, this amazing thing has happened in this part of the world. You know, there are going to be athletes coming out of there. Let's go to this one place where a lot of them are going to be at the same time and see what there is to see. So,
yeah.
But it comes both ways, but I think more in magazine and with a beat that's not sort of traditional mm-hmm. for our magazine, I have to generate mm-hmm. you know, a little bit. You know, Junior Seau dies and it's connected to brain trauma and sports. Like, that's sort of an obvious one that I'm going to be writing about. But otherwise, I generate a lot of my own story ideas.
Yeah. Now, with the Olympics coming up, most of the stories that y'all will do have basically a kind of a freshness date to them. You know, you won't be running stories about the Olympics in October unless there's some big controversy. So there's kind of a built-in deadline for some of these things. But on other stories, like you know, you've done series on concussions, and the set of stories that you were nominated for the Livingston Award was on pain. Those kind of stories that don't have a kind of a freshness stamp on them. Do you have a deadline for those? When you come up with the idea, you go to the editor and say, look, I want to do this, and they say, okay, we're holding a space for you in next month's magazine, or how does that happen?
That's a good question, and because you're absolutely right. Like, with the Olympics, it's like a circus tent coming down.
Yeah.
Like, the next day, it is so gone.
Mm-hmm.
So with the story, like, about pain in that package, actually, it, tellingly, I probably turned that in many months before it ran. And so there was a time I said, look, we'd like to have it in by this time. Because the area where feature stories go in the magazine is called the feature well.
Yeah.
And the area reserved for the longest stuff is called the bonus.
Mm.
And so they said, hey, look, we're trying to regenerate bonuses, and they always want a couple in at the same time so you can run them, and, you know, depending on the advertising, you know, that dictates to some degree the number of pages there will be and that sort of thing.
Hmm.
And so in that case, since it didn't have time, they said, hey, we'd like to have it in. And then it was sort of a waiting game until, you know, news slowed down. I think that series actually ran shortly after the college basketball tournament, probably because there's a lull right then. And
right.
So we had some more pages available. Because I turned it in way before then. They said, look, we'd like to have it by this point, but that had nothing to do with when it was going to run. So, yeah, some of those longer ones, you know, like the Samuel Njiru story, a reporter from Kenya, who basically wanted to run as we came up to both the Olympics and the first anniversary of his death. So it sort of depends, but for me, I tend not to have as many hard time deadlines, except at things like the Olympics.
Or when there's a tragedy like Junior Seau's death.
Absolutely. Then it's whatever the next issue is.
Yeah.
That's what it's going to be.
Then it's get it done quick.
Absolutely, yeah.
Now, one thing that people may not realize is how much editing goes on behind the scenes. So, not that you're not all gifted writers. I mean, many of us write in many professional senses. But there's always someone that looks over our shoulder at the end and works on the article as well. Those are the editors. So how much editing usually goes on your stuff? I mean, do you turn it in and they take 3 weeks to do that, or...?
Well, so the first answer is less than it used to, because I've started to learn, you know, as much as, like, we're all in love with our prose as writers, we also are writing for a product that we want people to buy, and so you have to fit the voice and your audience.
Right, right.
So I've really learned, the longer I've been here, I've much more learned sort of the SI voice, and, you know, I can see much more now things that an editor can say, like, no, that's not working, or the questions they're going to ask you to fill in details. So now, for me, compared to the daily reporting I did in the past, both at an internet publication and a newspaper, the depth of sort of scene reporting in a magazine is so much greater than what I was used to. Where before I'd ask someone, let's say you're painting a scene of them at breakfast, you're like, oh, he was eating breakfast, and it was this time, and it was this kind of day. I ask people the dumbest questions now. Like, they must think I'm just a total goofball when I'm interviewing them. I'm like, what color were your Cheerios? Like, how did the temperature of the milk feel? You know, it's just like this unbelievable level of detail. And that's because when I first turned in pieces, they'd ask the editor to put notes in asking all these questions for these little things. So I'm like, all right, I at least need that in my notebook. So if they ask the question, you know, I'll have it. So I've started to learn to self-edit in that way.
Yeah.
But if there's an SI writer who ever writes under the word count that they're assigned, I've never met that person.
Yeah. Well, most writers don't, right?
Yeah. We all come in a little bit long, and we all say, like, hey, can't you just make the picture a little smaller, and can't you just squeeze the text a little bit more? And so a lot of times the editors come in fitting things to space and trying to do it in the most painless way, and some of them are quite adept at that.
Yeah. So is that a good relationship usually between the writer and the editor, or?
You know, there's a joke among writers, that, like, if somebody goes from writer to editor and say, oh, like, can I see your scar? What scar? Oh, where they took your soul out when you became an editor. I think, like, you know, and even the word, the terminology that's used for stories to get, you know, if you write a story and it never runs, it's called killing, you know, it's called chilling or spiking the story. It's all, like, very violent language. Or,
yeah.
Or if an editor thinks you're writing in too flowery of a way and you love some detail, but it's not really perfectly pertinent to the story or doesn't fit, they call it, you know, drowning your kittens or killing your babies. It's like all this really violent stuff that I think sort of reflects this, like, inherently antagonistic relationship between the writers and editors.
Yeah.
That said,
yeah.
I think everyone realizes they need and benefit from editing. And I think the writers sort of gravitate toward working more with editors who they find they have a good relationship with and who they feel like includes them. When things have to get cut, I think it makes all the difference if the editor can make you feel like, you know, you had some hand in the process, even if you didn't.
Sure. Do you pick your editors that you work with? I mean, the statement that you just made it sound like you pick your editors, or do you have much choice in that?
To a degree, you do have some, because there's one editor who almost always edits, like, the bonus, that long piece.
Yeah.
And so he's one particular person, and so if you're pitching a story that you know is 5,000 words or more,
yeah,
like, he's the person that you're going to be going to.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm pitching something that I know, you know, it's pretty science-centric, there's an editor, actually, who hired me who was, you know, dropped out of med school, kind of a guy after my own heart. And so I'm going to go to him first because he's interested in this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And he can help you, you know, build a little momentum in the office for it. Otherwise, there are people that cover sort of different sports.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you'd say, well, if you know you just have a straight football story, then you're going to the football editor. But definitely, I think people... particularly if it's not a direct, particular sports story, they're more likely to start off with an editor that they've just had a good working relationship with.
Yeah. Do you find that you're having to produce more verbiage now because of the different media outlets, the iPad, the podcast that are out there, the internet, besides the magazine, than what you saw when you first came into the business?
Well, yes and no. So the yes answer is yes, since I first came to Sports Illustrated, because now we have the iPad, and we have unique stuff on the iPad that doesn't run anywhere else, and stuff in the you know, on the web that doesn't go elsewhere, and I mean, I'm tweeting and all this stuff, so yes. That said, before I came to SI, I was at daily publications.
Mm-hmm.
So then I was writing a lot just because of the nature of those publications.
Yeah.
But certainly since I've been at SI, the sort of amount of different things, I mean... You know, like even our communications people, you know, will want us to get on TV and radio, and so there's a lot of different, definitely, between, like, Twitter and doing other media appearances and our website and the iPad, and not only the iPad, we have a Galaxy version, you know, probably we'll have other tablets and the magazine. It definitely, there's definitely a smaller number of people and more work.
Yeah. I would bet many of our listeners didn't realize that there were so many different outlets that had unique content as what you just named.
And I actually write for SI for Kids sometimes too, which is actually a really fun experience because those editors are very much happy to have you do whatever. And I sometimes enjoy writing for you know, the kind of the 12 and under audience and athletes. No, athletes never worry about getting interviewed by SI for Kids. You know, it's like they're happy to like SI for Kids. So yeah, there are a lot of those. You know, and I don't know if you ever see, like, if, you know, when a team wins, like, a national championship in football or basketball or whatever, you might see, like, a commercial that's like, get your SI, you know, whatever, like, Alabama special champions package.
Yeah.
And that's like, a separate issue. So for the Final Four, if it's four big schools going to the Final Four, we'll have parts of four different, like, championship commemorative issues prepped.
Wow.
And three of those go in the garbage.
Wow.
So there's that also.
Yeah, a lot of verbiage that goes away that no one ever sees.
Yeah.
Well, Dave, we so appreciate having you back on today. Incredibly interesting bits here. We're going to be interested in watching the Olympics and the things that you've pointed out. And I would think that probably most people that listen to this will probably never look at Sports Illustrated and the similar content the same way anymore. But as always, we always give you the chance to give us a take-home message about what we talked about today. Anything you want to share with the folks?
Yeah, I do. I think, you know, despite those violent terms and what I was saying about the inherently sort of antagonistic relationship between writers and editors, it's the kind of, you know, knowledge that you acquire painfully that I think is really good for you. And whether it's turning to your friends or your colleagues, because sometimes people who aren't professional writers are really good at picking out problems and stories. And I think if everyone, you know, scientists, writers, when they write something, sort of turn to someone that they trust and get that feedback, you don't even always have to use it, it's going to be better. You're going to get better at writing. But that's just a fact.
Everything's better with feedback.
Absolutely. So you don't have to use it, but I know early on when I started writing, I was really self-conscious about my writing and scared to have people look at it and almost, you know, personally would take it hard if somebody had suggestions. But now I'm like, try to get it out to people and just, you know, have them hammer me, you know, the same way that you think of when you're training as an athlete, you know, tell me what error I can correct or how to get better. And I think that can improve everybody's writing. Like, I think some people start out being better writer than others, but yeah. Everybody can improve a lot.
Yeah. That practice makes perfect, huh?
Well, practice makes better.
Yeah. Well, Dave, thanks again for being with us today. And I want to thank all of you for downloading us and listening. Our T-shirt question of the week is a really easy one if you've been paying attention. And the question is, be the first one to send us the email, an email with the correct response, and that is, where is this Summer Olympics being held? So be the first one to send us that answer, and you'll get one of our nifty podcast T-shirts for you. Again, thanks, Dave, and good luck at the Olympics this summer.
Thanks for having me. Yeah. As always, it's a pleasure.
We'll continue to watch Sports Illustrated for your pieces, and we'll put that out on our feeds as well. And again, all of you, thank you for being with us, and we hope that until next week when we have another interesting individual from the world of sports medicine that you'll have an active and healthy week.
Thanks for listening to the Huffines Institute Weekly Sports Medicine Podcast. This podcast was produced by Cheryl Marek and Samantha Springer, made possible by generous support from the Omar Smith family and the Sydney and J.L. Huffines family. This podcast is published under a Creative Commons 3.0 license. That means you can't sell it or change it, but feel free to give it to everyone you know and talk and blog about us. And in case you were wondering, our openings and closings are provided by johnmilesproductions.com. Music was provided by David Zeltner. Find him on the web at davidzeltner.com. And just so you know, we love hearing from you. If you have questions or comments, please send them to huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu. From all of us at the Huffines Institute, we hope you have an active and healthy week.